tomorrow's the big day. Nice number, right? Tomorrow's the big day.
Wow.
Exciting stuff.
Nick, and that's been out a year. He said this new bunch, they're sending home 40 young men and they're going to get like 30 sisters. And no young men in the mix from Salt Lake, so.
Okay. Aubrey has one other sister in her district, and then Micah said that George has a couple sisters going to Denver. Her Denver North in his district.
Yeah.
I think that was like the contractor.
Yeah.
How's it?
He's not good. Mic is on.
Okay. The work session of the Morgan County Board of Education is called to order. And item number one on our agenda, we do not need to go into executive session. So we're going to just move right along. Item number two is board training. And if you look up on the on the whiteboard, that's very precarious, so I'm putting Angie in charge of writing on it and keeping it
tipping
from falling, crashing to the ground. But if you look at
wait, I'm just like adjusting it, or am I writing on it?
No, you're going to write on it.
Oh,
there's a chair for
okay.
You.
You're going to be on a white
and
I'm a lefty. Almost failed already.
But so there, we actually have our objectives up there, and the first two I'll be speaking to, and the second two bullets Andy will be doing. So number one, we're going to increase our understanding of how school boards can be advocates for special education students and their families. And the second thing that I will address is how to address community concerns, or when you have that constituent call you and say, I am so mad. So we'll be talking about those two things. And we'll start out with a question. There are actually only two main roles for a governing board in special education. And I'm going to ask anybody to be brave to try to guess what even one of those two roles may be. There might be chocolate involved if you're brave enough to venture a guess.
Well, my first inkling would be like related to budgeting and the funding that goes with it.
Okay, that's a really good guess. Any other guesses?
Well, I pulled up a cheat sheet. Oh. Is that cow or do I have to?
That you yeah. if you did the homework
you,
to pull up the cheat sheet, you deserve it. So, yep. What's one of them?
This one says to cultivate a philosophy of belonging.
Okay, so that's under the major heading, and absolutely right. So we're going to give you the major heading, and if you'll write. And you can color code to your liking, Angie.
Okay.
So on that side, please write advocacy.
On this side?
Mm-hmm. So advocacy is one of our two responsibilities. And the next one is actually response. Okay?
On this side?
That's on that side. And I sent out, like I said, the long version of this short version teaching, so you have all this information to go back and look at if you desire. And under advocacy, and we're just going to have four little bullets under there, and Angie, just abbreviate and make things short,
change color.
Short and simple.
Okay.
Change of colors would be wonderful. So number one. Andrea mentioned that we want to cultivate a philosophy of belonging. So just belonging. And I would say our two words for number two would be expectation, maybe three words, expectation for philosophy. Or maybe just leave expectation. It's a little bored. Okay? What that actually is talking about is we expect our senior leadership in the district to live that philosophy, and then to also ensure that our employees do the same thing. So that philosophy of belonging, that everybody belongs, is our philosophy. We expect everybody from the highest leadership positions to every staff member to actually live that. And then our third one, let's put number three here, because some of these, number three kind of actually ties in with the two things that we're going to have Andy talk about. But number three is that we as a board need to invest proactively, and this is what Angie said, so you were right, you had one of these subheadings, in staff training resources. So all of those things that it's going to take, including parent engagement, to make that a successful venture. And the last one under advocacy is decisions. And I put great big question marks after that, Angie, because what that's reminding us of is that every time, as board members, we're making decisions, we should be asking, what are the implications for special education students? Okay, so let's jump over to the response. And
wait, I gotta make it look like Mario. There we go. Okay.
Perfect. Okay, so response, we're gonna use an acronym, and you might wanna write this in big bold letters under response. The acronym is RAP.
Oh, I almost put it backwards. RAP?
RAP. RAP.
Yep.
And the R stands for reflect. The A stands for assure. And the P stands for propose. So as you have that email from a constituent or that phone call, you're going to think to yourself, okay, RAP, RAP, you want to reflect, assure, and propose. And there are just a couple of little tidbits of advice that will be under each of these. But before I give you those two things of maybe how to do that reflection, how to provide that assurance, what it is that you'll propose, there's, with each one, there's a caution of the thing that we need to remember, and that's actually what I want to start with. So under reflect, here's what, as board members, we need to remember. It's important not to indicate whether you agree or disagree. Okay, you're not making a judgment as, oh, you are so right, we better get right to this, or yeah. So we just don't indicate to that person, oh, I 100% agree with you, or I totally disagree with you. So that's our caution, that's our remember thing.
And then, keep writing these?
No, actually, you can just sit there and rest for a minute.
I'm like, I can change colors if you need me to.
Okay. Or if you hear something that you think, oh, we better put that up there, feel free. But under reflect, that's to remind us that we want to reflect the feelings and perspectives that are being stated. So those are your statements like, if I understand you correctly, you're saying this. I'm hearing that you're concerned about, and then it's whatever. So just those reflective statements that helps that constituent know that you really are listening and understanding what they're trying to say. The second, assure, here's our caution. Avoid stating to a parent that the district will or will not do whatever they are requesting. So we never say, yep, I'm sure we can get that taken care of, just give me a little bit of time, or isn't gonna happen. So we don't say that, and there's a reason, well, several reasons, but we just don't want to state to a parent that their request, we're not gonna say one way or another whether it will or will not happen. But we do assure the parent that the school team has their students' best interest at heart, and or that this is something that can be discussed further. So you give them one of those, or both of those assurances are probably appropriate to give that parent. Then we move on to propose. So here's our caution. We need to remember board members nor superintendents cannot make decisions for the IEP team. So they need to send people with their concerns to the team. So propose that the parent contact the student's case manager or find out who they have reached out to, and if that seems to be the case manager, then you're going to encourage them to climb the chain of command. Okay, who is the next person that they would visit? Probably their building principal. And so you encourage them to climb that chain of command, and then I like to always say, you know, please get back to me in a week or whatever seems appropriate to you, but please get back to me in a short amount of time after you've had a chance to go through these steps and let me know. You know, just keep me apprised of how things are going. So I'm gonna wind up so that we can turn the time over to Andy, but I just want you to remember that we have two purposes as far as our board role with special education. One is advocacy, the second one is response. And you just take a quick look at those things. We want to ensure that belonging is something that's in every facet of our district. We have expectation that that's taking place. We invest proactively in our funding, in our training, in our staff, in our parent engagement, and all of our decisions should address what implications are there for special ed in that. Then to your parents, you reflect their feelings, you assure that the school team is really the advocate of the student, as well as the parent is the advocate, and that there might need to be further discussion, and then you propose that they go to the correct people. Okay, that's my little spiel, and I'm going to turn the time over to Dr. Jansen for
my spiel.
Do you want to read those other two?
Certainly. Yeah, President Adams has asked me to address the district's responsibilities in serving students with disabilities along with our liability in providing those services. And then the second part, she's asked me to address the resources that are required of the district in order to meet those student needs. What I want to begin with, and the note I paid myself, is I think the most important thing for the school board to recognize from the outset is that special education is not optional. It is a legal entitlement. And the board's responsibility actually extends beyond simply approving budgets or new programs. The board does not determine individual special education services, but the board is ultimately responsible for ensuring that the district, we as a district as a whole, we have the capacity, we have the resources, policies, which everyone should be aware of, and then we, President Adams alluded to this a little bit in her portion of the presentation, that we have the culture necessary to provide every eligible student what we refer to as a free appropriate public education under IDEA. So what creates liability then is our failure to do any of those things, right? That can incur financial risk. And most importantly, what that does is that jeopardizes the educational outcomes for students with disabilities. That's ultimately the bottom line. And so we talked a little bit about this earlier also. In the best way, or I guess I should say, investing proactively in special education is not only a legal obligation, but it's the most effective strategy we have for reducing that risk of liability. How that ties into the resources required to meet student needs, I think ties in kind of like to the shortfall we're addressing right now with special education. And I think I would start off by stating that shortfall that we're addressing is not due to overspending. Okay, we have that's different from being proactive in investment. The district has spent several years correcting what I refer to as an underinvestment in special education services. And at the same time, while state and federal funding has remained largely disconnected to the actual service costs that we have in our school district. And so the factual story with regard to funding is that one, special education expenditures have increased substantially over the course of the past several years. Student needs and service expectations have also increased. Staffing and programming over the past several years have been expanded. Federal funding during that span has always has, Steve, I need a nod there, and continues to remain relatively flat. And state funding, even though the legislature will tell you that the WPU has increased, has not grown proportionally with those expenditures. And so that gap each year continues to increase. That resulting gap is what has been absorbed with our local district funds. So that's the story. There is kind of a, and I'll give you, I don't want to take too much time, but I can give you kind of a succinct historical arc to this. And that is that several years ago, the district special education program was operating with fewer resources than we require at present. Student needs were becoming more complex, and expectations for services were not only increasing, but staffing and programming had to expand in order to accommodate the needs of students. So the district we have continued to invest in teachers, we have invested in aides, we have invested in specialists, in some situations, addition of specialists. Transition services, I would also add to that, transportation services come along with some of those services that we provide for students, and then enhanced programming in order to meet the needs of our students and meet the legal obligations we have under IDEA. And this has increased our annual expenditures from approximately, and Scott, remind me if I get this wrong, from about $2 million to $3.8 million was the rough numbers that we've looked at over that, or that I think are correct over that span. During that same period, federal funding, again, it increased, but only modestly. State funding increased, but not at the same rate as our costs. And so what the district has done over the past several years is absorb the difference. We've been making up for that gap. And so the result is the current $1.15 million shortfall that you see, or that we've indicated. And I think the most important point is that the $1.1 million that we're talking about, we're discussing currently, is not a petition for funding of future expansion. It is funding of services that are already being provided to students today, and that we have been providing. People in our community hear new funding, and what do they assume? They assume new spending. And those are two different conversations. So what we're describing is the students are receiving these services right now. The employees are already working right now. The question that we have is whether we permanently align our budget with the services we are already providing. So if we can permanently address this shortfall, we move from a reactive position to one that's more sustainable over the long term. We can focus less on the funding gaps and more on things like improvement, taking a look at efficient and strategic staffing, and serving future students that come into the district as we continue to grow. Even though we're in, right now we're in kind of a trend of declining enrollment. So this is, as it relates to this, this is not a proposal to expand services. It is a proposal to permanently fund services that students already receive today. I thought that would take longer.
Actually, that's all I have. That's perfect. And that's, you know, that's what I felt like was really important for the board to understand as we, you know, as we've looked at this possibility of holding truth in taxation, and actually our 1.7 million that special ed, you know, is a considerable chunk of that. But I think it's really important for us to actually know the bottom line of those, and In just a minute, we'll turn the time over to Scott, but maybe while we still have the superintendent to kind of explain to us, because, and Scott, if I'm wrong, you can correct me when you go into this, but a couple of those items on our list were actually new things like the post-high school transition program is not something we've had before. The classroom size reduction at Mountain Green Middle School, and that sounded funny to me. And so I had to have a conversation with the superintendent, and I'm going to actually ask him to kind of give us the information about those expenses as well.
You want me to give you the information on both of those expenses?
Yeah.
Do you want me to talk first about the post-high?
Uh-huh.
And then?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, because that ties right into what we're talking about right now.
Well, before we transition out of special education, sorry, I was just going to say how helpful the glossary provided at the end was. I was just about to ask about some of the, there's so many acronyms when it comes to special education.
At the end of that email we were just talking about?
Yes, and education in general, there's just a lot of acronyms.
Yeah.
I was just looking through there, I'm like, oh, there's a glossary, and it's telling me all of what FAPE is, what IDEA is, but yeah, so thank you. Anyway.
And I say thanks for looking.
Yeah, right? I'm reading through these, like, oh, yeah, okay.
So post-high transition programs, I'll say, they're designed for are students who are now young adults, and but who have disabilities and who have completed high school, but they're not quite ready for full independence, employment, and in some cases, further education. So that's a short way of describing what post-high is. Each of you should have in front of you a handout, kind of a infographic that I created on post-high that, you know, you can peruse at your leisure. But I've also invited Jordan Melendez and Brecken Peterson from the high school who first approached us about the post-high program and who will oversee its implementation and execution. So if the board has any questions specific to what, or if there's anything about our program that might be unique to us or that differs from what you can see on here, I thought it might be a nice opportunity for the board to get it straight from those educators who will be overseeing those students.
Nice.
Is there anything else you guys would add to my short description of post-high? I think it's important to note that back to the fact that special education is a legal obligation. These students with disabilities are entitled to remain in the public system until the age of 22 in the state of Utah.
Eligibility-wise, though, it's not everybody that has an IEP gets.
No, it's not.
It's eligibility. So it's usually the kids like Brecken and Jody would be in charge of. That's why they're here. Those kids that the IEP team, as a team, decides that a regular high school pass is not appropriate and need 3 or 4 more years to reach their potential goals. So connect with adult services, get the families to take responsibility, those kind of things.
And so at the point where those students reach complete 4 years of high school, and those students who the team, their case managers determine are eligible for ongoing services, they have from 18 to 19 to 20 to 21 and 22. So instead of simply having them continue to redo,
So right now, Morgan is probably one of the very, a handful of districts in probably the United States that don't have an actual post-high program. So right now, our cute little kids are special ed, in our class anyway, are continuing on. Jody and I are doing the very darndest that we can to help give them the community interaction and what another district's post-high is doing, but we're also running a caseload of 13 other high school students at the same time. So we're doing our best, and so it's just due time that Morgan is part of the rest of the world, you know, in this post-high program. And so right now, our current Morgan High School special ed students, a lot of them are just doing 8 years of their same curriculum in high school. And then that 22 comes, and it is a cliff for those families because it's now what? You know, they don't have any kind of job. They don't have any kind of, there's so many connections for these families in the community and going back to acronyms and people and places. They have so many supports that so many of our families in Morgan right now just don't have. I'm lucky enough to be part of the Special Needs Mutual Program outside of the district stuff, and we have a huge, huge, huge community of special needs people here in Morgan that honestly a lot of you probably don't even know about, because as loving and as wonderful as we are in Morgan with these kids with special needs, there's no supports in place for these families. And so this is exciting after high school. So it's an exciting time for these new families coming up to provide this post-high situation for them, because our job now is to help these kids become active adults in their community and get all the supports they need. And it's just really cool and important. So
I'd like to clarify what Brecken said. There's not any adult agencies that provide adult services up here. So we've always provided services till they're 22, but there's nothing up here for the families to connect with unless they're willing to go down the hill and move their kids to group homes and all those kind of things. So
once they complete high school, those services have become redundant.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions, board members, that you have right now? Okay, if you'll, Superintendent, just take a couple of minutes and kind of explain to us that next sheet, why a simple student-teacher ratio can misrepresent staffing, because I think that, that kind of explains those other two costs on our list.
Yeah, because when enrollment falls, staffing doesn't always fall with it, right? Which is counterintuitive. So I thought trying to empty my, I'm not as good at articulating this, so putting my thoughts in and creating an infographic might be helpful. When we use the simple formula for determining our teacher to student ratios in our schools is simply taking the total enrollment in a building and dividing by the number of teachers. And so in order to meet the stated thresholds, or the thresholds that the board seeks to maintain, which is, I believe, 20 students at the elementary level, 24 students at the middle school, and 28 students per teacher at the high school. And this works really well in an elementary, and the primarily because most students are all receiving the same type of core instruction. You can simply take the number of students in a grade, look at how many teachers you have, compute that, and decide whether to add or reduce students. And so those numbers are proportional. That's not to say that it doesn't work at the secondary level, the middle or high school levels. That can and has worked effectively up until now with our two middle schools, and the decline in enrollment, particularly at Mount Green Middle School, and the enrollment cliff that they're coming up on down in Mountain Green. It's once you get down to a certain level that you have to maintain what's referred to in this infographic as minimal viable programming. Because at that point, we're talking about the number of sections that you have to offer in order to meet the needs of all your students, particularly in the elective, arena. So if you look at this infographic, when we look at staffing, at the middle school, we're not just looking at enrollment anymore, we're looking at the programs that are offered. And so if we just divide the number of students by teachers, right, and go by that same formula, what that prevents us from doing is providing all of the elective opportunities, or in here refers to the sections, the courses that we've been teaching. So we're ultimately, when we do that, we're telling the administrators to decide between class size and programs. And so the reason I picked the numbers I did is when you get down into the 400s and the high 300s, this is when you start to see that discrepancy. Like I said, it can work just fine when you have larger numbers of students, like at the high school. This is actually the way that the high school determines their FTE needs. And they've still been able to do this, but they're starting to feel this a little bit too, is they look at the number of sections they need based on the number of requests they have from students, and that's how they decide how many teachers they need. They don't just take the total number of students. And so that's what you have to take into consideration, or we have to, we're kind of being forced to consider as we deal with declining enrollment, is that we might need to look or consider that in addition to class size. And so in our district, and what some districts do when they get down to enrollments like that is, you've heard a lot of districts across the Wachish Front, they close schools. That's not where we're at, but what we have to weigh and consider is if we're going to continue to offer foreign language in middle schools, CTE, music offerings, then we have to be comfortable with maybe smaller class sizes, and that can come with some added expense. And so that's kind of what we've experienced over the last year or so, is we're coming up on a situation where we're still trying to, and we were able to do that effectively this past year, is fit into that our traditional formula of student-to-teacher ratio, and then as we transition to the spring, we've had to ask teachers to do more to make up for that. So the request from the middle school administration is to maybe ease that burden a little so that they can continue to provide those programs without asking the teachers to take on, you know, to give up prep periods or take on more preps. At the same time, that's kind of a double-edged sword, because in order to counter this situation, one way to counter it is to find teachers who can teach multiple subjects in order to still offer, you know,
programs,
elective opportunities for students. So
lots of juggling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Down below you'll see, you know, there's some, I think we've got five responses listed there. Those are things the board probably wants to weigh and consider, especially as we go through the next year and approach, you know, the next hiring cycle going into next year. There isn't just one way. There's a number of ways, and as we, you know, achieve, hopefully we now have a situation at Mountain Green that will allow us to achieve greater continuity, and that'll give Michelle and Jenny an opportunity to work, and they already work really well together, and maybe come into alignment on what minimum programming looks like at our middle schools in a way that we can still offer or provide these opportunities for students, but still maintain a ratio that's not only, you know, kind of what we're known for, but that's comfortable for teachers.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Something that comes up every year, it seems like, is the question about fifth grade being in middle school versus elementary. How would that affect the scenario? Would it make it worse, better?
Well,
if fifth grade was?
We have asked, and we continue, and that is the direction we're going. We try and operate with the two schools within a school model, and what we've asked both middle schools to do is to, they still function on an elementary model with their fifth grade students. And so we can still do that in the middle schools effectively with fifth grade students by having assign them each to a teacher and using a traditional formula of that can still remain proportional.
So the additional FTEs are more like 7th, 8th grade? Is that what you're saying? Or is that like the
Yes, problem? Yes.
Okay.
I think the curiosity would be, if they were moved back to the elementary, would that alleviate some of the staffing concerns or make it worse?
No, because we can maintain that same staffing model regardless of the geographic
location,
regardless of the physical space, right? One of the big concerns you hear in our district...
This is mostly the 7th, 8th.
Secondary is what causes it because of the elective?
When we first opened up the middle school in Mountain Green, the stated objective was to have 5-6 as its own entity at 7-8.
Right,
and
right.
Since, I mean...
But just having the total enrollment fall to a number that now becomes precarious, it's just curious if shifting some of that makes it better or worse.
For staffing?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think it... Regardless of where we put them, we can still operate on an elementary model with our fifth grade students in the middle school or in an elementary entry building. I was going to say, we do get a lot of anecdotal feedback from parents who have concerns about or apprehension about their fifth grade students being with those older kids. That's kind of an interesting transitional grade, and so that's part of what we've done. We've been able to do it at Mountain Green Middle more effectively than we have at Morgan Middle, is kind of separate those students physically from those upper grades, and that's kind of our mission here in acquiring the seminary building, to creating that space so they can operate on a different model, which they do. And that's how Mountain Green Middle School has adjusted for their addition of a fifth grade teacher this year, knowing that next year, just based on students to teachers, they will be, if enrollment stays the same, that they'll have to move that teacher, one teacher out of fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
So most what this has to do with is we're talking primarily about grades 6 through 8.
Sure.
That's a good question.
Any other questions?
Is there a minimum threshold if we continue to experience declining enrollment? You know, if that cliff you're referring to keeps dumping, what's the number where that school is no longer viable? Is it
the school?
Uh-huh.
Is there a number?
In Warren County, we don't have a stated threshold.
Okay.
I don't think that's a bridge we've had to cross.
Yeah, it's such an interesting.
Other districts, when we visit with other districts about that and we ask them, hey, what do? When you get down to this number or that number, they're like, oh, that's simple, you close the school. We hesitate to say that out loud because, you know, we don't, but we do have, you know, we do have a situation. That's not the only way to combat that either. You know, closing schools is one way that larger districts address that problem. Boundary realignment is another way to address that problem. I'm not aware of in Morgan County that the board has ever stated, we don't have that on a stated threshold.
With projected growth models, I don't see it ever coming, but the numbers, the way we see them right now, are really interesting.
Especially comparative to what they were for more than 10 years.
Planning,
you know,
to go up, up, up. Yeah. Now we're looking at down, down, down. So it's,
it is interesting.
I think the timing is really good to be, I think this has put us in a situation where we're looking at these and we're ahead of it enough to start focusing on that and maybe formulating a plan moving forward.
Thanks. Thanks for offering that information. I thought that might be helpful to all of us to kind of have that background. And now I'm going to turn the time over to Scott. And
okay, so you all received the update and received our certified rates last night, and so we will send you that update. The new growth ended up coming out at 1,472,525 across both capital and board. And what's included in the proposal that I sent you was shifting the funds from capital into board, just kind of reallocating that. We're in a pretty good place capital wise, assuming that the board's not planning to build a new school. Based on our previous conversation,
we're probably
pretty safe on that. And so as this truth in taxation process works now in May, we don't know those numbers, and so we generate a wish list, and we have that wish list in front of you, and now we have what money we have available. So we have that 1.4 million available, 1.7 million of requests, and so the board's options are to hold the truth in taxation hearing in August and raise that additional $275,000, or look at, you know, maybe scaling back on this wish list. And so what was included in the recommendation I sent out to you was maybe taking some of these and funding them with one-time money out of fund balance as a pilot program to be revisited next year. And all the discussion we've had previously is kind of building to that on a couple of those that make sense. So we'll have a budget hearing tonight at 6 o'clock. That's scheduled, where we'll present the budget. I have a copy of it here for you. I guess before I hand this out, is that a direction that the board wants to go? Do you want me to pursue?
Can I add a thought?
Maybe we have some discussion before we jump in.
Okay, let's open up for discussion.
I'm not sure. My question is, I've talked with Scott and Andy about this already, and I can bring it up again in a regular session if needed too. But I personally, I'm liking the option of like that one-time thing, not having the truth in taxation. But an additional thing that I would like to keep an eye on, with some data from principals and stuff, is continuing to fund program. Well, I don't know if programs is the best, positions that were COVID money. So like the school nurses, we've got four. I know that some of those, or some or all, are part-time, but looking back at to see if we can, if that's something in the budget that we can look at again next year, if we go this route that you're proposing too. Kind of a luxury item, and like I don't
it's not anything against any individual or anything like that, but just with like all the numbers dropping, and maybe like next year we're in a different spot with new growth revenue. Who knows, right?
That's
one that last item, the 100,000. Like I want to kind of keep an eye on. Like, is that necessary to keep going? Because that's
well, and absolutely, we can and should keep an eye on all of that. I would say
the school nurse 100,000.
Uh-huh. I would say
because that was COVID money. That's right.
If you spoke with building administrators and personnel, they would tell you that school nurses are a critical component now, and I think, you know, absolutely that's...
I agree. Like, I had a student that was diabetic last year and had to go to get her levels checked at lunch every day, and there's special cases, but then again, like, at my school, I share a nurse with... there's at least 3 schools. Like, we see her once a week, I think, but...
Yeah.
Other than that, the office staff helps with Band-Aids and ice packs and whatever, boo-boos.
But
no, I know that there's certain needs, and we discussed a specific
too. It stands to reason to me. I think it's reasonable to take that extra 300,000 that we're short, and we've worked really hard to build our fund balance so that we have a little bit of cushion in that event that, you know, we have the really hard things hit, that we can still cover our basic costs. And that fund balance went quite high for a while, and now it's down on that lower end of the spectrum. I think we're at about 3 months, right, Scott? And I personally hate to see that get much lower than that. So I'm all in favor of that plan for this year. Let's dip into that to meet the needs that we need to meet without holding truth and taxation. Mm-hmm. And then be prepared that we will be looking at data again next year to see where we're at. And that's one of the challenges, because it's like, just yesterday, Scott received that certified tax rate, and until then, we're just going on his very best estimates, which are usually pretty good. But I'd like to open this up to discussion or feedback here, so that we want the business administrator in our regular board meeting to know which way to fall off the fence, right?
I talked to Scott as well, and we went over this and some other issues, and I like the proposal that we have in front of us for the coming year. The advantage of appropriating the money on this one-time deal to see where we're at next year makes good sense. Also, we talked about the nursing thing and just seeing, follow up with some research to see what the legal part of it is across the state. Because back then, I mean, it was forced and it was going to be, and so I'd like to find out what they say we need to have to protect ourselves legally with the students and that. But I agree, I don't think we need to have a truth in taxation, and I think this is a great, great proposal moving forward with the circumstances we're in. And I smile at the fact that we worked so hard to get the six-month budget, because they mandated you had to have 6 months. Now they're backing down. That I don't want to see it get much lower than 3, because we've seen in the past it can go you know where in a hurry. But as far as tonight and this information, I like what we see. Appreciate the hard work.
I was just going to say, it sounds like we all met with Scott at some point in the last week or so to answer questions, and I feel like a lot of the questions that I came with tonight have already been answered in the presentations that have been given, so that's really helpful. And, you know, we're not the only ones with some of these things. All the COVID money, I mean, I was just reading something on it, maybe one of our emails from USBA or something, like, we're all facing that, right? Positions that were created are hired with COVID money, and we're facing, do we still need those? Where do we get the funds? And so when we get this one-time funds, then it just makes for a lot of decisions in the future. And that's what, I guess that's my only concern, is if we do like fund them like one time, and then you hate to create something and then go back and be like, oh, now we hire people and now we don't need them or different things. And
I think if it was something completely new we were coming up with, that would be an issue. But we're just looking at continuing something we were already doing right now while we can, and then looking at it again next year just to say, have things changed? Has the revenue increased? Has it decreased? And then taking a look at it as necessary.
And then with the school lunch costs, which we talked about, was it last month when food services came? I can't remember if it was last month or the month before. I mean, that's just something we have to look at every year, because none of us can control. That's affecting every family in America
right
now. So that's something we have to continue to look at also, is what,
yeah,
what we put back to the families and what we put on the taxpayers.
Well, and I feel like it's the right decision. When Jan came last month and said she feels like we should keep those lunch prices the same, which means that the board has to come up with some additional money, but I feel like that has been the right decision for this year.
Which is where we get it every year, right?
Okay, any other questions before we take a little break before our regular meeting? Okay,
we will. That answers your question.
Yep.
So we're all good with this.
So
looks good.
At the hearing, so I have a budget that it has the $1,000,004 rather than the $1,000,007 included in it for you guys to approve tonight.
That's what I was going to ask. Is what will happen?
Right.
I'm adjusted. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
So that's the one we will be approving. Hey, thanks everybody. I think this has been a great discussion, and thanks for your help with the training. And by the way, some of you earned chocolate absolutely during that. So, Angie,
wow.
You should.
You
have
did
a,
all the.
You should have it all.
And she was the scribe. Oh, thank you.
That's probably now again.
Yeah. Oh, can we take down the bulletin board now? I can't see it.